Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Back to the normal double-header format. Nimrod Flaschenberg will examine the economic and class dimensions of the uprising in Israel, and AI critic Duane Monroe returns to look at the breathless reception for the latest version of ChatGPT. Over the last few weeks, Israel has been in turmoil, with millions out in the streets to protest the right-wing coalition government of Benjamin Netanyahu, a.k.a. Bibi. Bibi was prime minister from 1996 to 1999 and again from 2009 to 2021, and the governments he led were always quite right-wing. He returned in December to assemble the most right-wing government yet. His coalition partners include seriously reactionary parties that represent religious fundamentalists and crazed settlers in the occupied territories. Two of the most alarming ministers in the government come from those parties: Itamar Ben-Gvir, minister of national security, a violent racist, and Bezalel Smotrich, Minister of Finance, a self-described fascist homophobe. He was once arrested for plotting to blow up a highway, but he got off. The furthest right parties have been pushing Netanyahu to strip the courts of the power to invalidate legislation, a move that would open the way for even more repression of Palestinians than we see now. Much of the Israeli population has reacted with alarm to the proposal, which is one of the main reasons for the massive demonstrations of recent weeks. It was too much even for Biden, who gave the Israelis a sharp talking to. On Monday, Bibi withdrew the proposal, but it's not clear for how long. And, as compensation, he offered Ben-Gvir the opportunity to create his own private militia, a truly terrifying prospect. With more, here's Nimrod Flaschenberg, an Israeli writer based in Berlin and a former advisor to the Hadash party. A few weeks ago, his Hadash comrade Noah Levy was on the show to analyze the crisis. Here's another look from a somewhat different perspective. Both are contributors to 972 magazine. 972 is the country's telephone calling code. Nimrod Flaschenberg. Is your country falling apart?
I don't know if it's falling apart. I don't think we're just yet there. But it is unprecedented challenges on the street and demonstrations. And in fact, the right-wing coalition is behaving quite differently from how you would expect. Netanyahu used to be a very competent leader with all of his shortcomings and problems that are many, but he used to be very competent, and it seems like he is no longer in control. It seems that the radical right is working him. Right now, between these protests, the threats of refusal by army reservists, and the financial breakdown that is possible, I think put together, it is a very, very strange and unprecedented time, and I don't know where it's going to lead. I think also there's international pressure that's mounting. Biden spoke very, very harshly against the legal overhaul plan yesterday. I don't expect much from the U.S., but it is clear that they want to make this stop, and they have the power to do so.
Did Netanyahu's retreat on a court reform, did that have any effect? Or is that just a temporary measure?
It's a minor retreat. It was obvious that once a general strike was announced after his Ministry of Defense, you know, announced that he's not going to support the reform, Netanyahu had to do something to stop this building from falling down. So I think he had to freeze it. And in any case, now, you know, it's holidays soon here. The Knesset goes on recess. So it was the timing that all of the protests and his plannings were mounting toward this week. So he's going to freeze it. But I think after he froze it, people on the opposition were not sure if this is a way of, you know, ramming it through more slowly in a gradual way, or is it a real stop? And I think that maybe the reaction from the international community could be a sign that it's not going anywhere. In any case, he has the parliamentary majority, but also his coalition is frail right now.
Yeah, but no, how are the furthest right members of his coalition? That's kind of funny to talk about people further right than him, but, you know, how are the furthest right people taking this?
Well, that's Netanyahu's achievement right now. Like on Monday, the dramatic day in which the general crisis happened, Ben-Gvir was threatening that if Netanyahu freezes the legislation, he will leave the government, maybe support it from outside within the coalition, but not as a part of the government. He's not doing very well in his post as Minister of Police. Eventually, they struck a deal by which Ben-Gvir will get his own small army, a militia group that will be used to attack Palestinians, I guess, inside Israel. And that was the deal that was struck. But I think Netanyahu was able to keep his right flank in order. What he was fearing was that his Minister of Justice, Yariv Levin, would quit. And that could probably be the first step in the government's crumbling. This did not happen, sadly. So right now it seems as if he was able to, at least for the time being, stabilize his coalition. But it's temporary.
But if the government fell, what would take its place? I mean, the society seems really full of fissures.
Well, you know, we had five election campaigns. I was very active throughout these many years of tough political fighting, in which, in general, you could say that the country has been moving rightwards. That is a fact. That is what's going on. But I think in this case, the Marxist analysis really helps, or the Leninist analysis. There is an intensification of antagonisms that is happening now because the right-wing government is so extreme, is, you know, trying to go so far. And I think we are seeing, it's not widespread, but we are seeing some notions of radicalization on the other side. And also, for the first time in these 3 years of so many election cycles, voters are moving from Netanyahu's bloc in the polls. This is happening for the first time. His like moderate right-wing supporters are realizing that he went too far.
Is there any vehicle that would act as an alternative to him?
There are many. They're all very centrist. They're all very problematic. You know, it's Gantz and Lapid and the usual suspects, very militaristic, very right-wing, not in any way progressive on the Palestinian issue. And there is the parties representing the Arab population that could be a weight against the power of Netanyahu, but there is no real joint political program between the centrist and the left that is mostly led by Palestinians. So I don't know if I could imagine like a better coalition. There could be like a unity government. But I think there is a chance that the extreme right, like the settler-led occupation-intensive government, will not last for eternity, as we did feel just after the elections, you know? So there was a shift in like the dynamism of politics did awaken in previous months, in the last few months.
Okay, let's talk some about your piece about the Israeli economic model of recent years. You quote economic historian Ariel Krampf as calling it isolationist neoliberalism. Could you develop that theme? What does it mean?
Yeah, I think like in general, and I don't want to put things in Ariel's mouth, it's my reading of the case. Israel's economy, since I would say the early 2000s, since Netanyahu's first term as a finance minister, actually, and this is very connected to Netanyahu, has been developing this model that by which the high-tech industry is an export-oriented industry that produces high-valued goods, is sold around the world, and this is paired with this notion of regional, militaristic, aggressive, diplomatic position. If in the 90s, during the Oslo years, there was a different type of neoliberalism that was more inclined to integration in the region and so on, this type of neoliberalism is based on military might and this isolationism. But I think the most important thing is the investment in high tech. Like high tech was a significant portion of the Israeli economy in the early 2000s, but now it's dominating completely and is the driving force.
This is the startup country story, right?
Yeah, exactly. This is the startup country and all of this. You know, so many of them are connected to military industries or cyber and so on, but many are not. And this industry is like very, very profitable. It pays its professional employees huge salaries. It's increasing the Israeli GDP, but it is also increasing the Israeli inequality. And as we saw in this protest, it's not very well integrated into the state itself. You know, like in a way, most of these companies could get up and move at any given moment. This is what we are beginning to see. Since this protest began, and the high-tech sector, both its managers and its workers, are very significant inside this protest, we have been seeing a decrease in, you know, it's connected to the general case of what's happening in high-tech, but we've been seeing a lot of high-tech people talking about moving their companies abroad, or moving themselves abroad, or moving their finances abroad. And this is a general phenomenon that we see among the Israeli elite.
And while the economic model delivers prosperity for the high-tech elite, it's not so great for everyone else, right? There's a lot of polarization and poverty.
Yes, of course. Like Israel's welfare state was disseminated during the 90s and early 2000s. This was another part of Netanyahu's project. And in general, this model is also based on a very tight budgetary policy. So a lot of foreign reserves, but a very low debt-to-GDP ratio. So, in fact, it was a constant tightening of the belt in which the high-tech was the locomotive that was driving the economy, and the rest were just left behind. So the gaps in Israel have expanded dramatically. Since entering the OECD, I think it's almost always ranked among one of the last countries in terms of inequality inside the OECD. And this was not the case, you know, like in the 80s or 70s.
I'm speaking with Nimrod Flaschenberg, an Israeli writer and former advisor to the Hadash Party, now based in Berlin. There's a line of thinking that the judicial reforms, Netanyahu's politics in this government more broadly, would lead to economic isolation, a kind of realization of the BDS dream here. What do you mean by that?
We need to speak about it in relative terms. I mean, obviously, the Israeli economy is very, very strong and has a lot of reserves, and it can last, you know, quite a bit of challenges. So I need to qualify this by saying, you know, it's only relative. But I think that the Israeli economic model was based on the fact that, you know, even if it was promoting apartheid and, you know, occupying another country, it was a good place to do business in. And this legal overhaul, whether in terms of the legal space, but more importantly, in terms of like how the Israeli elite feels about itself, makes the country seem like not such a good investment. And joined with the crisis in high tech in general, I think there is a big possibility of a downturn in the Israeli booming economy. There is also like, you know, if we talk about like the similarities to the BDS campaign, we are seeing, you know, I see it all around me and like people I know, people from the middle or upper middle class in Israel are, you know, taking their money and putting it in banks abroad. People who have access to foreign passports are getting them in order for them to, you know, secure their future. There's a very frightening prospect in Israel, and it's destabilizing the economy and the society. So, you know, it's very connected. It's not only like an economic phenomenon.
Of course, an end to Israeli democracy, which people talk about, that's not necessarily bad for business.
Yeah, I think this is the picture people are trying to paint, that it's connected. I think an end to Israeli democracy that never existed, but never mind. Like, let's talk about it within Israel. You know, the democracy for Jews only. If it ceases to exist, it will be bad for high tech. It might be good for other industries, like the weapons industry and the cybersecurity industry, or other, you know, the gas. Now Israel found gas, so maybe for that. But I think for high tech specifically, there is a very strong link to, you know, liberal circles around the world. And I think like the high tech people, the Israeli high tech people would want to, many of them would want to move their business elsewhere. It's not about, I think, democracy in the true sense of the interest of the capitalists. It's more an issue of stability and, you know, cooperative population or elite that could do the business work here.
From what we know of in the U.S., the political thinking of some of the high-tech people, they're pretty anti-democratic. They have a reputation for being libertarian, but that means freedom for them, but not necessarily for the rest of the population. Is there something similar among the Israeli tech elite?
It's funny. I think not to that extent. I mean, it's libertarianism is a small phenomenon in Israel. It exists. It exists, I guess, like disproportionately in high tech, but it's not dominant. I think like what we are seeing in recent months is that the high tech sector in Israel is just, you know, a reflection of other sections of the Israeli elite. It's very connected to the military. It's very connected to like this collectivist national understanding of Israeli society. And it's also like it's been telling this new story about Israel as this high tech nation, and it's believing that story. So I think like there's a lot of implicit racism in this idea of like a Jewish genius or something that I guess is quite a strong sentiment among many Israeli tech people. But in general, no, I don't think it's libertarian. I think it's just like liberal, you know, while forgetting about like the most acute violations of human rights that are happening just around the door. Don't have many good things to say about them.
The other side of the libertarianism, you know, look at somebody like Peter Thiel, is they're quite authoritarian and anti-democratic. Does that apply?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, I'm sure there are types like that. I could think of some. But in general, I think that the authoritarian forces in the Israeli society are more connected to much more to a different project, and that's the settlement project. I think like the Israeli right is promoting religious conservative fundamentalism that is very authoritarian and very, you know, homicidal in a way, like we saw in the pogrom in Hawara a few months ago. I think the tech sector is, you know, it identifies itself mainly with like Israeli centrism or Israeli liberalism. I don't think this phenomena of the Peter Thiel types is very prominent in Israel.
And the rebellion that we're seeing in the streets, a lot of that is pretty upper class people. This is a rebellion of the elites.
Yeah, right? I was there a few nights ago when we blocked Ayalon, the main highway in Tel Aviv, or the main highway of the country, for hours at night after Gallant was laid off. I saw the people, you know, like I would say it's the general Tel Aviv public. Like now it's very so widespread that it entails like large sections of the Israeli society. I would say, yes, more or less aligned with the upper middle class and the capitalist class. But it's very clear that its leadership is connected to the Israeli elite, the high tech elite, military elite, of course, is very significant there. And also people from kibbutzim, which are a different type of elite. It's very Ashkenazi, in, you know, in Israel, there are Jews who came from Oriental countries and Jews who came from Europe. So, like, I think there is a clear ethnic divide here, because Mizrahi Jews, more of them support the government's parties. So, yes, it is a rebellion of the elite. I would say it's more of a counter-revolution than a revolution, but it is now so widespread that it reached huge sections of Israeli society. Like a recent poll suggested that 19% of Israelis were present in at least one demo in the past 3 months. So it's quite significant.
Wow, that's a lot. Is any of this good news for the Palestinians?
This government was probably the worst news for the Palestinians imaginable. I mean, they appointed this guy Smotrich, who is genocidal maniac, I'm sorry, but that's just the right attribute, to be the minister of occupation, of the civilian side of the occupation. They put Itamar Ben-Gvir, a convicted terrorist, to run the Israeli police. So I think like once the elections were over, it was clear that things are going very, very bad. And since the beginning of the year, more than 80 Palestinians were killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank. So things are very, very bleak for the Palestinians, and for the prospect of, you know, any future peace possibility. My optimism, my terrible optimism suggests that maybe the international pressure that we're seeing and the estrangement of the Israeli elite from this government would eventually translate into also including the question of the occupation in this calculation. Because, like, it is very clear that the people who are advancing the legal overhaul are settler leaders that are interested in annexation, that are interested in ethnic cleansing of the West Bank and so on. And I think this link is important to make, and I think some people who didn't make it are making it now. So this is my sliver of optimism.
Thank you for offering that. They're hard to come by these days.
Yes.
That was Nimrod Fleschenberg, an Israeli writer based in Berlin. You can find his articles on the 972 magazine website at 972mag.com. It's interesting that, as Nimrod said, the U.S. has the power to make Netanyahu stop his judicial reforms. It makes you wonder what else the U.S. has the power to do. Maybe stop Israel from terrorizing Palestinians both within its borders and in the occupied territories? Representative Jamal Bowman and Senator Bernie Sanders are leading a congressional effort to urge the administration to investigate whether U.S.-funded or produced arms are being used to abuse Palestinians. Of course they are. You barely need an investigation to confirm that. So far, this effort has only a few supporters, squad members like AOC and Cori Bush, but it is a start. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. That was some of the cadenza that Beethoven wrote for Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 20, performed by Friedrich Gulde. Next, artificial intelligence. The hype over ChatGPT, already intense when Duane Monroe was last on Behind the News a couple of months ago, has gotten even more so with the release of its latest iteration, and Google's release of its rather sad competitor, Bard. I thought it would be good to get Duane back on the show to deal with the frenzy. He's an Amsterdam-based software engineer who has a side gig doing Marxist analyses of the tech industry. Duane Monroe. Duane, since we talked last, there's been an awful lot of hype. I mean, well, certainly a lot of hype around AI for a long time, but the hype seems to have accelerated to a new level here with the brilliance of the latest iteration of ChatGPT. We've got Google's now trying to do the same thing. I typed a prompt into Google yesterday to do a bio with me. It was more accurate than ChatGPT, but it's got a flatter prose style. I don't know who's programming these things. But anyway, you know, the level of hype that this is just so world-changing and breakthroughs we've never seen before, no precedent for inventions of this magnitude. I'm sure you're familiar with all that. What do you make of it?
I've given this some thought, actually, in preparation for our conversation, and I think I can break it down to four major factors. The first factor, at the material level, is the fact that Microsoft invested $10 billion USD into OpenAI. And what that means is that Microsoft is employing its massive marketing apparatus to promote this technology as, you know, as the next big thing. Because obviously they need to see a return on that investment. Everyone loves Satya Nadella in the industry, or at least many people do, but I'm sure that their shareholders and the board are looking for results. The second thing is, as you mentioned, Microsoft's competitors in the space, Google and Amazon and others, who don't sit on quite the same Olympian perch, have a fear of missing out, right? So Microsoft made this announcement, this merging of their tech stack with OpenAI, and that had everybody going, oh my God, this is amazing, and so forth. Amazon, who's accustomed to being perceived as the leader, no doubt found themselves experiencing some FOMO and decided to do their own thing, but it's not as flashy as what Microsoft has managed. And Google is also thought of as the leader, but they are playing catch up. So that accelerates things as well. The third factor is the pivoting of many, many, many crypto hucksters very quickly away from the burning wreckage of the crypto space to AI hype. I use LinkedIn as an intelligence gathering tool here, because if you follow LinkedIn, how would I say, with a keen eye or a cynical eye, you can learn a lot about what's happening. And then finally, and this is more conjecture, but it's a sense that I have, the tech industry is increasingly desperate to keep its illusion of being a miracle factory going as limits are reached. I mean, there are new iPhone models, of course, but it's just no dramatic breakthroughs. And many things that were promised, like self-driving cars, are really a non-starter. So I consider this to be kind of their final gambit, because they can't build time machines or warp drive or any of these things. And so this may be it as far as them pretending that they're building the future.
Well, you know, you sit down and type a prompt in this thing, and some of them are pretty amazing.
Yes.
And, of course, people find that very impressive. Right. A friend of mine had asked it to rewrite the opening of the Communist Manifesto into Valley Girl speak. And it was amusing. It was well done. I asked it to write a column in the style of Thomas Friedman about ChatGPT, and it was pretty terrible. It didn't really capture the style of Thomas Friedman at all. Mm-hmm. But somebody told me I needed to use better prompts. But I don't know. I think it should be doing the work, not me. But anyway, what do you say to someone who's just like, wow, gee whiz, I just typed this thing, and look what it came back with. I'm really impressed.
Yeah, no one, even those of us who are strong critics, no one is doubting the technical acumen of the teams that have produced the systems. Just as we don't doubt the technical acumen of people who produce an F-16 fighter plane. Obviously, they're quite adept at what they do, right? But the actual question is, what is the impact? And what is the cost? Not just the financial cost, but the material cost. And what is the purpose? The question I always bring up to techies who get very excited is, why did Microsoft invest $10 billion in OpenAI? And if you think it's because in the halls of Microsoft or any corporation, there was a gathering of elders who said, yes, we must advance human knowledge. Well, I have a bridge to sell you. Maybe several bridges, actually, if you're willing to believe that sort of thing. And so, yes, that we have to separate our admiration, or at least our acknowledgement of the technical capacity of the teams that produce these things, from an analysis of purpose and impact.
Okay, what's going on behind the scenes? You know, I type this prompt. In a few seconds, it starts typing back at me. What's going on exactly during those seconds, and how does it produce this prose?
So at a very high level, what's happening is that, or the way that these large language models do their tricks, is that text has been analyzed. Well, I should say, to begin with, text has been vectorized, that is to say, turned into abstract mathematical tokens that can be manipulated by a computer, because, of course, a computer doesn't know the words. It doesn't know that if I were to say a sentence, I am talking to Doug Henwood on a Wednesday, well, the computer doesn't know what any of that means. But what you can get a system to do is to turn each of those words into a mathematical token. And then these tokens can then be found over and over again within patterns, because our languages have grammatical rules, loose or strict. But they have rules. Whether one is trained or not, in some strict sense, the way people speak, the way people write, follows rules. And because that's a bounded space, even though we are quite creative with our use of language, as Chomsky has often said, I believe it's what is infinite use of finite means, even so, there are rules. And so the mathematicians who have developed the algorithms that these systems use can take advantage of the fact that there are patterns to then give the systems the ability to produce plausible text, to see what should the next word be. And we're not unfamiliar with this from past experience. We know this from the autocomplete systems that we've been using for many years now. It's just that this is very similar, but on steroids, because there's a much larger corpus.
Where do these texts come from? What text is it scanning that's the raw material?
The internet is a large source. So Wikipedia, Reddit, Twitter, Facebook, so forth and so on.
That's like a collection of human stupidity, too.
Well, it is. And, you know, and also, of course, you know, any text that's available online, like Project Gutenberg, many, many things are available that these systems siphon up, vacuum up into their massive corpus of billions and billions of parameters. And then what I should also add is that you have the cleverness of the mathematics, but you also have the application of massive amounts of computing power. Now, recently, there have been some announcements that you can also do this on your home computer, depending upon the specs. And that's nice, but that doesn't change the fact that it requires a good amount of computing power to do the kinds of things that ChatGPT does. And so the combination of the clever mathematics and the massive amount of computing power that is brought to bear is what enables it to produce this plausible text that we find convincing and impressive, because this is how we've grown up. I mean, we are beings who make meaning, right? So if a machine produces a sentence that makes sense to us, well, we're going to be impressed. We're going to think, well, maybe this machine is talking to me. This is the same thing that Joseph Weizenbaum talked about, I believe, at MIT in the 1970s with the ELIZA program. I mean, and my God, that's a lifetime ago. And yet it was the same principle for a much, much simpler program with much, much less computing power at its disposal.
Okay, let's go back to the development of this stuff. OpenAI, what kind of firm is it? Who's behind it? What funding did they have? And how did Microsoft stumble upon them?
OpenAI started, I believe, around 2015. It was founded by, among others, Peter Thiel, Elon Musk. Sam Altman was there from the beginning, as I recall. And the idea, its mission statement, was that AI is a very powerful and potentially quite useful technology. And so, as the name suggests, we, OpenAI, will produce our results, our breakthroughs, our research will all be open. And then everyone around the globe will be able to make use of it and advance state of the art in an open fashion so that whatever dangers may exist can be examined openly. Well, that lasted for a bit, but Microsoft turned its attention to OpenAI, and a few years ago, Microsoft began work with OpenAI by producing the hardware that OpenAI was employing. Microsoft built a supercomputer for OpenAI called Voyager ESU2, I believe is its name, using many, many thousands of NVIDIA or AMD processors. And then the direct investment is what has signaled this merging of the interests of the two organizations. My opinion, just as a longtime Microsoft watcher, is that this is part of what used to be called an embrace and extend strategy, in which you make an investment, and then eventually you have complete control of the thing that you invested in. We see this, or steps along that road, with the fact that OpenAI's technology kit, ChatGPT, and so forth, has gone from open to closed, that they're not talking about sources and methods, they're not talking about power consumption, or any of the vital things that researchers or just people who are curious want to know. And as I mentioned before, the fact that it's deeply integrated with Microsoft's Azure cloud platform, but also as Satya Nadella announced about a week or so ago, in the Microsoft 365 productivity suite that corporations around the world use, with Microsoft 365 Copilot, in which, like Clippy, which those of us who are of a certain age remember Clippy, you know, you would start a Word document and this annoying animated paperclip would show up and say, oh, I see you're writing a letter. Microsoft has had a long-standing ambition in this area of intelligent assistance. This is the fulfillment, I think, of that mission, which started under Gates, actually. So the fact that there's such a deep integration of OpenAI's technology stack with Microsoft's cannot help but mean that it's going to be closed. I mean, Microsoft certainly didn't open up the source code for Windows or Microsoft Exchange to the world. And, you know, with this investment, they have no intention of letting what now is considered a strategic and competitive secret to the world.
I'm a pretty heavy user of Word and Excel, and in many ways they're very good, very useful. I couldn't work without them, but they're still not great after all these years. There's so many things that are still wrong with them. Microsoft has never had the reputation for being terribly innovative, and you know, Clippy is kind of dorky and not very cool.
Yes, it was very goofy.
So Microsoft doesn't seem like an ideal fit for what's supposed to be such a cutting edge technology. What do they bring to it?
What they bring is deep integration with corporations. And that's the thing. So as a person who's been in the industry for a while, when I would work with younger colleagues, they were always talking about Google. It was Google this and Google that. And then a little later, Amazon via AWS. That was the sexy kit, right? If you wanted to be the cool kid, you built cloud stuff on AWS, and your productivity suite was on Google, and you did your development against those environments. But meanwhile, people who were actually making money in various industries that were not sexy and that were not really concerned about the valley at all. They just wanted to do whatever they were doing, whether it was coal mining or making paperclips or anything. They were using Microsoft. And Microsoft's penetration into that corporate substrata is quite deep and almost impossible to dislodge. And so what Microsoft brings to the table for OpenAI is the ability to operationalize this at scale, which I think we talked about in our previous conversation, which other companies simply could not do. Amazon is a bit too rapacious, not that Microsoft is not, but there's a flavor to Amazon's way of doing this that's a bit too grabby from the beginning, whereas Microsoft, I think, is a bit more like Mark Antony, those sweet words. And then the knife comes. But at first, there's a lovely speech about how honorable you are. And Google, well, I think that people who actually want to get things done in a business environment understand that Google is not the company to help you get that done in an efficient manner. Because we already see this with Microsoft. I mean, they move so adroitly, whether the products are terrible or whether they are useful to people, they move quite adroitly to integrate these products with their existing product line. And the way that they have pivoted is actually, we talked about things that are impressive but not helpful. Well, this is an example of that. It is impressive how they have actually productionized this, but it's not helpful. But they demonstrate the value to OpenAI of this partnership, I think.
I'm speaking with the software engineer and longtime critic of artificial intelligence, Dwayne Monroe. So what practical applications will this have for Microsoft?
Well, during the demonstration that Nadella and a few other senior executives at Microsoft gave when the Microsoft 365 Copilot product was unveiled, was the promise of people being able to just generate text via Word, for example, and also the use of PowerPoint to be able to generate images. So, for example, you can see a value of this to companies in which they don't have to pay artists anymore to do, and that is Microsoft, that's their hope, I'm thinking. They won't have to pay artists to produce art for, say, the backgrounds for PowerPoint slides. And this seems minor, but it could have a rather large impact on the prospects for the armies of people who produce some of the things that happen on the background that make these products attractive and useful to people. Of course, it's built upon the work of artists already who are not being paid. That's what DALL-E certainly does. Just as ChatGPT is built upon the text of people. It didn't just start writing things out of the blue because it's, you know, some kind of genius system. That's the productivity suite side. On the Azure side, I believe that what Microsoft's gambit is here is to create what's called an application programming interface, or API, sort of superstructure, in which companies around the globe will build a large language model, that is to say ChatGPT and DALL-E style systems, having to pass through Microsoft as the way to get access to the system, and therefore pay a fare. They will become like the central hub, the monopolistic controller of access to large-scale computation of this sort.
For whom? Corporate clients?
Yeah, for corporate clients, primarily for large corporate clients. So you can imagine, and also for startups. There'll be many startups who in the past would have had to have stood up their own environments who now can say, well, via an application programming interface, an API, we can make use of Microsoft's what's called OpenAI Cognitive Services, plug into that, and then build our service with their service on the background, and then sell our service to other people. So the term I use is that this makes Microsoft the super rentier, and these other services kind of the sub-rentier in a way. But all roads would then lead to Microsoft.
I have some friends who've been programmers, and they've had ChatGPT write some pretty simple scripts. What are the possibilities of replacing programmers with AI?
It's not surprising to me that there's a number of repeatable software development patterns that can be done via Copilot, which is the product, the ChatGPT, or the large language model built code creation system that that Microsoft developed a while ago. It's not surprising because there's many things. Like, let's say, for example, there's a function where you just need to grab a file from location A and drop it to location B. That's something that, you know, is done over and over again. It's quite simple. And there's other types of functions that developers use, libraries that they use over and over again that don't require a lot of creativity. So it's certainly helpful to developers to be able to grab those sorts of things and sort of autofill those functions and then tune them to your need. Now, there's more complicated types of software development or more tuned types of software development, like, let's say, for example, control planes for chemical plants. And there's all kinds of computation that the internet scale development does not take into account. And so I think that software developers will not be out of a job, but that doesn't mean that companies won't believe that they can replace them. This is kind of the big problem, is that you can see companies foolishly letting people go and then hiring them back at lower wages, you know, because they thought they could replace their development teams with ChatGPT or Copilot. And then they discover to their dismay that they cannot. They just can't have prompt engineers, it's now called, saying, oh, you know, make me a program that does the following things. And it's produced and then it just runs. That's quite impossible that you would from soup to nuts just build something that was addressing, say, your customer's needs, your customer's requirements via a total automated fashion. But I think that companies are going to believe that. They want to believe it because they think that they can then get rid of these very expensive developers and replace them with automation, which, of course, is always the goal. My God, I mean, as far back as NT4O, which was a server operating system that Microsoft produced in the early 1990s, Microsoft was marketing that as being so intuitive and so intelligent that you wouldn't need server administrators who are, of course, expensive. Now, that was a lie. But there were companies all those years ago who believed it and actually got rid of people, only to discover that, you know, nothing worked after a few weeks.
Now, we've seen many times in the past the threat of being replaced with a machine has had a very demobilizing effect on the working class.
That's right.
It makes people inclined to surrender, to be very agreeable. Right. Are we going to see this extending into new areas now?
I think so. This has long been my critique of so-called AI, which is as a propaganda effort. Like, it doesn't matter if you can build self-driving trucks or not, but if you keep saying you can, and no one is telling people that that cannot be done or what the challenges are, then, of course, maybe truckers would believe that and then not demand what they are due. Because the company might say, no, you know, if you have better working conditions and better wages, we can replace you with, you know, this computer. Of course, that's a lie, but that lie can be used strategically. And I think, yes, part of this hype is indeed that if you detangle the hype and look into it a bit more deeply, you do notice that one of the themes is every job is on the chopping block. Everybody's job is on the chopping block. Now, just on the face of it, that's just completely absurd because you ask people simple questions like, well, what, my dentist will be replaced by ChatGPT? I mean, you know, like, you know, the dog walkers will be replaced by ChatGPT. I mean, my accountant who has to deal with, you know, various tax jurisdictions will be replaced by ChatGPT. What are you talking about? But obviously, the attempt is to demobilize at the highest level. And then there are the willing idiots who just kind of go along with this because they think it's just exciting. They don't even know what they're talking about as far as what the implications would be, even if that were true. And it's not. And so what we have is this assault, I think, on the will of workers to stand up for themselves.
I was interested in your comment about the crypto hucksters moving into this space. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, the collapse of Sam Bankman-Fried's FTX exchange, the collapse of so many of these exchanges, and the collapse of the entire crypto market, along with the collapse of the Web3 delusion. My God, like last year, I was hearing nothing but Web3 all the time. People were just Web3 this and Web3 that, and then you would ask, well, what is Web3? And then you would collapse into some kind of gyre of nonsense. Those people, of course, as delusional as they are, they have no choice but to accept the fact that they're not making any money on crypto. And their goal is to make money. And if you're not making money, then why are you continuing to hype it? And so they're pivoting to AI because now the big players are actually helping them with the hype. And there are major corporations, you know, that are buying into it. And so now there's an opportunity to sell yourself. And you see this on Twitter. You see this on LinkedIn. There are people who are just marketing themselves as the experts to help you and your organization understand how to make the most of this bold new era of AI. Now, there's nothing they really can help you with, but there's executives and various other people who are quite foolish who will believe it. And so there's an opportunity at this time for people to take advantage of the hype train in order to make a living for themselves.
Now, this requires an immense amount of computing power, right, behind the scenes?
Yes, it does. Yeah, quite a bit. Thousands, for example, ChatGPT running on the Voyager supercomputer, many, many thousands of computational elements, not to mention cooling and all the rest of it.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's like a tremendous power demand. So this is not exactly what you'd call climate-friendly stuff.
Well, no. And we know that there have been various – it's difficult to get hard data because the companies, of course, are very stingy with it for obvious reasons. But, yeah, there's some good indications that data centers have become a very large generator of carbon, of a carbon footprint. In other words, that the amount of energy that they are drawing or what's required to generate energy for them is not helping us at all. And also, it's important to remember that data centers in which these supercomputers reside take up real estate. So, you know, there's just acres upon acres of land, just in these flat warehouses filled with computational machinery.
Well, it's funny because, you know, the illusion of everything around tech is that it's weightless. You know, this goes back to, the myths of the late 90s, the new economy business. And it's just so deeply material. Its material demands are enormous. Yet people, I mean, it's easy to understand why people get this feeling. It just seems like mysteries are happening behind the screen that you can't even imagine.
That's right. One of the reasons that I am immune to this is because I worked in the data centers, as I mentioned a few times. Like I cut my hands and hurt my knees, like racking these giant servers and getting them configured and getting them running, being super chilled in a data center and monitoring these systems as they, having my Friday nights wrecked when a system would go down and so forth and so on. So none of it is immaterial to me. I know exactly what these guys are doing behind the scenes, but that's a privilege, and it's a privilege that fewer and fewer people have access to, actually. And I realize that it's a privilege because, yeah, it just so happens that my career followed the path that allowed me to work on large-scale systems, and that's why I feel it's important to kind of share whatever I know about this.
So finally, what is the correct attitude to take towards this stuff? Fear, extravagant hope, a shrug? What do you say?
I would advise being alert to impact. Number one, remember that there are computers behind the scenes consuming power and that they're part of supply chains. So toss the ethereal idea out of your head. And number two, always focus on impact. What are these things used for? Not what people tell you, but what can be tracked? How are these systems impacting people's lives? And you're not going to get that information from Microsoft or any of these companies. You'll have to seek out others who are doing work, such as Timnit Gebru and Emily Bicker and others who are doing really good work in trying to uncover the impact of these systems on our world.
That was a software engineer, Dwayne Monroe. You heard Dwayne making fun of last year's hype about Web3. Longtime listeners may recall that we had Molly White on the show to demolish that piece of foolishness last June. Behind the news, though it was in the critical cutting edge. After we recorded the interview, Dwayne apologized for mangling the name of one of the sharper critics of AI, Emily Bender. She's at the University of Washington, where she specializes in computational linguistics. The other name he mentioned, unmangled, was that of Timnit Gebru, who was driven out of Google for her criticisms of AI. Among her objections was the racial bias of facial recognition, she's of Ethiopian origin, the ecological harms of the intense computing power behind the apparent magic, the racial and other biases incorporated through the model's uncritical appropriation of existing texts, and the potential for abuse, such as fooling people because of the apparent credibility of their prose output. The paper that turned out to be too much for Google had Emily Bender as one of its co-authors. On Wednesday, a group of tech luminaries, including Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak and Renaissance man Elon Musk, whose allegedly self-driving cars have been in hundreds of accidents, causing numerous injuries and deaths, they signed a letter calling for a pause in AI research because of its social risks. Among the risks they named were the spreading of propaganda and untruth, a funny euphemism for lies, job destruction, and loss of control of our civilization, though you have to wonder about the quality of the people who are controlling civilization now. Emily Bender, the AI critic I discussed earlier, greeted the letter with a string of critical tweets. Among them, "I'm glad that the letter authors and signatories are asking, should we let our machines flood our information channels with propaganda and untruth? But the questions after that are just unhinged AI hype, helping those building this stuff sell it." That's the end of the quote from Bender. Besides, constraining this research would require a political system rather different from the one we live under. But maybe we already live under that system I'm dreaming of. Well, no, but let's for a moment step into the fantasy world imagined in a speech a few weeks ago by Donald Trump, speaking at the Conservative Political Action Conference.
"The sinister forces trying to kill America have done everything they can to stop me, to silence you, and to turn this nation into a socialist dumping ground for criminals, junkies, Marxists, thugs, radicals, and dangerous refugees that no other country wants. No other country wants them. If those opposing us succeed, our once beautiful USA will be a failed country that no one will even recognize, a lawless, open borders, crime-ridden, filthy communist nightmare. That's what it's going, and that's where it's going. I used to say that we will never be a socialist country. I said it oftentimes. But I'd shout it out loud, and I was right, because that train has passed the station long ago of socialism. It never even came close to stopping, frankly. We're now in a Marxism state of mind, a communism state of mind, which is far worse."
That was you-know-who speaking to CPAC on March 4th. "We went straight to communism without passing through the transitional socialist phase. Who knew?" That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this Some of Peppers from the new album by the newly engaged Lana Del Rey. Till next week, bye.
Take a minute to yourself, skinny dip in my mind.